Welcome to the Left of Lansing podcast with your host, Pat Johnston. A progressive insight into Michigan's political and cultural world. A, dare we say, entertaining podcast designed to shine a light on how we can best make Michigan's political machine work for the people. And now, live from the Left of Lansing headquarters, located in his attic, here's Pat Johnston.
Welcome to another installment of the Left of Lansing podcast. Yes, 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 I'm still here. I didn't forget about you. I didn't forget about this, dare I say, awesome podcast. No, I didn't forget. But as I wrote on the Left of Lansing blog earlier this week, and by the way, that's leftoflansing.com, I was, shall I say, in a desperate need of some rest, relaxation, and recreating. This is what I wrote. I said, I reached near exhaustion around July 4th. I've been working hard for 18 straight weeks on this podcast. Lots of late nights, lots of long days, lots of research, lots of writing, lots of producing, lots of voicing, lots of computer screen time. Don't get me wrong, I love doing it. I wouldn't have started this podcast and blog had I not loved it. But I also do have a day job, and sometimes it takes up much of my time, especially since I wake up in the early morning hours. And by the time I get a little nap, some dinner, do some house chores, I don't have a lot of time to devote to this small enterprise. My ultimate goal is that someday I can devote my full time to this project. Of course, that would take some good old-fashioned progressive sponsorship and maybe even, a donation once in a while. However, I'm starting this from the ground up, and I knew this would be more of a public service venture for you in the near future. Plus, admittedly, there is a level of selfishness too here. I love giving my opinions and saying what I want to say, which is one reason why I started this podcast. So bottom line, all I can say is that I was in desperate need of some rest and relaxation. We all need a little break from time to time or else we'll burn out. What is it that Axl Rose said in November Rain? Everybody needs some time on their own. Yes, that is the first time I've quoted GNR here on the Left of Lansing podcast. It only gets better, ladies and gentlemen. I did travel recently with my wife and the Left of Lansing technical advisor, Dr. Heather, to the Traverse City Film Festival, and we had a great time. We saw some films, including some awesome short films by Central Michigan University students. Woohoo! You guys make me proud to be an alum. We also traveled up the Leelanau Peninsula and did some wine tasting, visited the Grand Traverse Lighthouse, and I provided some pics of that area on the Left of Lansing website, by the way. We traveled up to Old Mission Peninsula and did some wine and beer tasting up there as well. We drove up to Charlevoix and Petoskey, and believe it or not, and I'm not lying here, ladies and gentlemen, that's the first time I've been to those gorgeous areas in my 43 years living here in Michigan. I know. It shouldn't have taken that long because it is beautiful country up there. I didn't want to leave. And we did take some gorgeous pics of the Lake Michigan shoreline. And as the occupant would say, her record deepness. Record deepness, otherwise known as depth. And we also did capture some beautiful shots of our unbelievably tall trees, as Mitt Romney would describe them. But we did have a fantastic time. And I'm stating this objective fact right now. If you don't mind, Michigan is a beautiful state. It's no wonder why we see all of those Ohio license plates here in Michigan, because we rock, we have a beautiful, and we have a fun state. Not much to do in Ohio. That's why people come up here. Now, my next goal is to finally visit the UP. Again, I know it's inexcusable that I've never been to the UP. Please email me with some ideas on where Dr. Heather and I should visit when we finally make that trek up across the Mackinac Bridge. Oh, and before I get in trouble, yes, Heather's been to the UP. I have not, and she grew up in Pennsylvania. I know I've had to hear that for a long time now. But please email me, leftoflansing@gmail.com, and give me some of your ideas on where we should visit in the UP, including some breweries, please. Because that I'd like to visit some breweries. That's of the utmost importance to me. Hey, we have a thriving craft brewery industry here in the state of Michigan. So I'm rested and ready to rock this podcast again because there's too much going on and too much at stake for me to sit around and getting fat. It's time to get back in the game. As Michael Keaton says in the legendary Ron Howard film Gung Ho, now's the time, babe. And I have to admit, my hunger to get back into the studio grew after watching the heartbreaking but inspirational documentary at the Traverse City Film Festival called After Parkland. It's a film by Emily Taguchi and Jake Lefferman of ABC Documentaries, and not only was it a moving and emotional roller coaster, but then the El Paso and Dayton mass shootings happened exactly the next day, putting an exclamation mark on the need for us as a society to make some real, meaningful change to curb gun violence here in America. The film showed how the community dealt with the grief of losing their sons, daughters, and friends after the Parkland school shooting. It also showed how some of those loved ones used their grief to fight for real change. And it wasn't all just about gun reform. I'm going to be honest. One parent, whose pain was palpable throughout the entire film, didn't want to deal with guns. He did not want to deal with guns at all. Andrew Pollock wanted more security in schools. And while I may not completely agree with his stance, he did fight to get a bill passed in Florida to add more funding for school security. And that bill also did prohibit Floridians under 21 from getting a gun. So it was a bill that both pleased and upset many. But it just goes to show, and it's something that I talk about many times here on this podcast, that change can happen at the state level far faster than at the federal level. That's important to remember, okay? I stress that over and over. That is the point of this podcast, to highlight the progressive movement that's happening here in the state of Michigan and how we can make that change happen faster here in Michigan than perhaps over on the federal level. And if we can start making the change happen here, maybe then that will kickstart change happening on the federal level. That'll be a topic later here in this podcast. But the film also showed the courage of those Parkland students like David Hogg, who, along with countless others, took the country by storm in 2018 by starting the March for Our Lives gun reform movement. It's a movement that truly, truly helped change the gun debate landscape forever. There's no denying that. And while the Republican Party continues to ridicule and ignore these young people who want to end or at least limit school shootings and gun deaths overall, the Republican Party risks losing a generation of voters for a very long time. And I don't know why they're not getting it, because they will pay for this for a long time. For the time being, though, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is standing in the way of protecting Americans from senseless gun deaths. The occupant in the White House, who ran as a tough, independent dude, rolls over again and again and again for the National Rifle Association. And we've got a right-wing Supreme Court majority that for some reason fails to read the Second Amendment as it's written. I mean, it's reading 101, but they seem to fail reading 101. Or they're also bought by the gun manufacturing lobby. And that's perhaps why millions of Americans, like me sometimes, and I think like many of you out there at least one point in the past 20 or 30 years, kind of fall into having that fatalistic opinion that nothing can be done to stop this gun epidemic, this gun violence epidemic. Which is strange and disheartening, because we are America. We used to always find solutions to problems. As JFK said about going to the moon, we choose to go to the moon not because it's easy, but because it's hard. Yet I love hearing right-wingers constantly argue against gun reform laws due to the fact that someone will still buy a gun illegally no matter what you do. I mean, what kind of nonsense is that? It is unbelievable. I mean, they have this idea like, there's nothing can be done. Let's just pack it up and go home. Nothing we can do. Sorry. That kind of thinking is exactly what the right wing and the gun lobby wants. They want us to be despondent. They want us to feel hopeless. And guess what? It's worked. And it's worked for years. It's worked for decades. While we were driving back from Petoskey to Traverse City, we received updates on our phones of the El Paso shooting. And once we learned that the shooter was a white man, I knew that we'd be talking about mental health. Because you see, only white men deal with mental health issues. I mean, it's amazing that mental health issues are never, ever considered when a black man, brown man, or Muslim man commits murder. No, no, no. We've got to do something really big to prevent that from ever happening again. I mean, it's almost as if we try to give the white man the benefit of the doubt. You see, white men can't be up to evil. White men can't kill for political or what we would call terrorism reasons. No, not white men. Which is funny, though, because for years and years and years, the Klan proudly called itself a terror organization. For some reason, we forgot that. But there are two reasons why the occupant, his NRA-bought Republican Party, and their cult followers push this mental health reasoning. All right, and I'll give you those two reasons. One reason is to downplay the severity of white right-wing terrorism that has plagued this country, not for the past few years, but for the last few centuries. And two, it's also used to take the spotlight off the weapons that are used to kill. First, I'd like to deal with the right-wing terrorism point here, if you don't mind. If you recall, the conservative parts of this country had a collective conniption when the Department of Homeland Security released a report back in 2009 warning us of the right-wing terrorism threat. The report titled Right-Wing Extremism, Current Economic and Political Climate Fueling Resurgence and Radicalization and Recruitment studied the rise of right-wing extremism. It highlighted how this kind of extremism used the economic downturn of the financial crisis, that it used the fight for gun regulations, and it used illegal immigration to recruit people. And it also could result sometimes in lone wolf attacks. Now, this was not out of the question, all right, that these were possible outcomes. Those of us who remember the Oklahoma City bombing understood that fact. But you see, 9/11 forced us to turn our full attention to Muslim extremism. And that pleased the right wing so much because it took our eyes off them, you see. Now, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have paid greater attention to Muslim extremism. Probably should have been paying attention to them even more before 9/11, George Bush. Yet while we spent trillions of dollars trying to combat that one threat after that horrific September day, we were not doing the same for the terrorists that we have here at home. We were not doing the same to combat domestic terrorism. They were able to grow with very little oversight. That DHS report tried to warn us, but once that report became public, the right wing in this country went ballistic. As Media Matters notes, conservative pundits like that nutty Michelle Malkin and Sean Hannity claim that this report showed how the Obama administration was attacking conservatism. Even MSNBC's Joe Scarborough back in 2009 said Obama was, quote, going after conservatives first, unquote, while he also scoffed that we had a right-wing extremist problem. That was back in 2009. It's 2019, and Joe Scarborough still has a nice cushy position at MSNBC. Isn't that nice? See, it pays to be wrong all the time because you get rewarded in corporate media land. In 2019, people like Rush Limbaugh and Tucker Carlson today are saying the exact same thing, that there is no real right-wing extremist problem. But we know from Anti-Defamation League statistics that right-wing extremism is responsible for the vast majority of extremist-related murder over the last decade. Those facts scare the hell out of the right wing, which spent two decades trying to make you scared of everyone else. Parker Malloy from Media Matters reminds us how it was just a few short weeks ago when Minnesota Democratic Congresswoman Ilhan Omar said on Al Jazeera's Up Front, and I'm quoting here, "I would say our country should be more fearful of white men across the country because they are actually causing most of the deaths within this country. And so, if fear was the driving force of policies to keep America safe, Americans safe inside this country, we should be profiling, monitoring, and creating policies to fight the radicalization of white men." Oh man, that drove the conservative base insane. How dare she talk about white men that way? How dare she talk about America that way? Because, you know, after all, she's Muslim. So we can't be stunned as a country when we learn the El Paso shooter's manifesto referred to the Hispanic invasion of Texas. I mean, we've heard that word invasion used over and over again by right-wing politicians, pundits, and by the occupant. The AP reports that the shooter, or terrorists, told authorities that he wanted to go after Mexicans. Plain and simple. Oh, and by the way, that 2009 DHS report about the surge of right-wing extremism was eventually pulled because the Obama administration was afraid of what right-wing pundits were saying about it. Ugh. Now, the other reason the right-wing ideology wants us to focus on mental health is to take the focus off guns and the easy availability to gain access to a gun. So, you know, we've heard how we should do more to prevent people with mental illness from getting a gun, or how video games are the issue, not the guns. I mean, my God, we're still hearing the same right-wing talking points from the 1990s, which means they have no ideas. They have no new ideas, which means they've lost this debate. I say that because Kristen Jordan Seamus from the Detroit Free Press on August 8th of 2019, wrote an article called "Trump Said Mental Illness and Hatred Pulls the Trigger in Mass Shootings. Experts Beg to Differ." It's an eye-opening piece, and I urge you to read it, and I will provide a link to it on the Left of Lansing blog. In it, Ms. Jordan Seamus writes about Arthur Evans, the CEO of the American Psychological Association, and his professional take on this issue. She notes that Evans is the head of the largest professional and scientific organization of psychologists in the United States. Evans told her that people must understand there is a fairly weak link between mental illness and mass shootings. The article goes on to cite a passage from the 2016 book titled Gun Violence and Mental Illness, which was published by the APA. In it, researchers said mass shootings perpetrated by people with serious mental issues accounts for less than 1% of all yearly gun-related homicides. Less than 1%! And Evans told Ms. Jordan Seamus that the biggest predictor of who is going to commit these crimes is violence, a history of past violence. Right there. Right there is the reason why more must be done when it comes to gun. If you recall, I had Dr. April Zioli from Michigan State University's School of Criminal Justice on this podcast last spring. She studies gun violence related to domestic violence, and she found that 55% of intimate partner deaths were by firearms. Dr. Zioli also told me that here in Michigan, we don't have the most stringent of laws preventing those convicted of domestic violence from getting a gun.
No, it sounds like what you were describing with Michigan is that we have pretty lax laws when it comes to this issue. Would that be right? Comparatively, I guess. Sorry about that.
We do allow the firearm restriction on dating partners, and we do allow it on those emergency orders. But we don't have a relinquishment law, no. And we don't have a law that says that firearm restrictions can be put on people convicted of violent misdemeanor crimes or domestic violence misdemeanor crimes.
We know the problem. We know the problem. But right-wing Republicans don't want to do anything to stop it. In fact, they want to go in the exact opposite direction and put more guns into society, put more guns into the hands of the wrong people. I mean, there's stuff that can be done to fix this. Instead, though, I just hear fatalistic talk that there's nothing that can be done. There are too many guns. And besides, just making a law doesn't mean bad guys won't break them. I mean, seriously, I've heard that half-assed reasoning this week as to why we cannot pursue any kind of common-sense gun reform. I mean, if that's the case, why have drunk driving laws? If that's the case, people will just break those laws anyway. I mean, why have speeding laws? Why have laws against insider trading? Why have laws against kidnapping? Why have laws at all? Thankfully, there are millions of us who refuse to take that approach. I'm happy that we have gun reform groups willing to take the fight to the National Rifle Association, willing to take the fight to the occupant, and willing to take the fight against conservatives hell-bent on preventing us from trying to save lives. I'm going to talk with a representative of one of those groups in just a moment. Her name is Emily Durbin, and she's the volunteer chapter leader for the Michigan chapter of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. She's coming up next, and it's a good thing because I have to admit, I kind of have that fatalistic feeling right now that there's really nothing that can be done, at least in the next year or so, when it comes to gun reform. But Emily, I think, is going to try to tell me no, that I'm wrong. So I'm glad that she's coming up next here on the Left of Lansing podcast. Stay with me.
It's progressivism with passion. It's the Left of Lansing podcast, where Pat Johnston shines a light on Michigan's progressive movement. Contact Pat at leftoflansing@gmail.com. The Left of Lansing podcast is available on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Google, and of course on leftoflansing.com. Word has it, that's Rick Snyder's favorite site. Now, back to Pat Johnston.
Of course, remember to visit leftoflansing.com to hear all of the previous podcasts, and I also post other thoughts and musings there as well. That's leftoflansing.com. Plus, if you'd like to contact me, it's very, very simple. Just email me at leftoflansing@gmail.com. Yeah, that's right. It's that simple. All right, you know, it didn't take long for politicians bought by the NRA, with the help of their propaganda media friends, to quickly revert back to their old playbook after the mass shootings in Gilroy, El Paso, and Dayton, which killed over 31 people. And I mean that we're now hearing how guns are not the problem. No, guns aren't the problem. No, we're hearing about mental health or lack of prayer or the prevalence of video games as the real reasons why we're experiencing mass shootings and gun deaths overall. I mean, I cannot believe that we're having this debate again, but we are. Video games? Really? I mean, that's from the 1990s playbook, and there is no evidence showing that video games cause one to become violent in the real world. It's an old playbook, but the NRA-backed politicians are using it again and again and again, and they're hoping it'll work once more this time around. But see, we're not living in the 1990s anymore, or even in 2012, because of the fine work many activists across the state and here in Michigan have done to get candidates elected into Congress and into state legislature seats so that Americans demanding gun safety and regulation have some real representation finally. One of those groups is Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. And joining me to talk about their work and how we can finally bring some gun sense in America is Emily Durbin. Emily is the volunteer chapter leader for the Michigan chapter of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. And I'm thrilled to have her on this episode of the Left of Lansing podcast. Emily, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
For those who may not be completely aware of the work that Moms Demand Action does, would you mind giving us just a brief overview of your organization and the kinds of work that it's doing to put candidates in office who will fight for real gun reform on the state and federal levels?
Yes. So Moms Demand Action is the nation's largest grassroots gun violence prevention organization. We have chapters in all 50 states and the District of Columbia and over 6 million supporters across the country. And our aim is to mobilize people in our community to end gun violence through a number of different strategies. So we engage in educational, peer-to-peer educational programs among adults to encourage people to responsibly store their firearms so that children and those at risk don't gain access to an unsecured weapon and harm themselves or someone else. We support survivors of gun violence. We elevate their voices. We train them to tell their stories so that they can communicate with other members of our country about the toll that gun violence takes in America. We also engage in advocacy around effective policies that can help to prevent gun violence. And as part of that advocacy work, we not only work to encourage our elected officials to do the right thing, do their job, and enact policies that will prevent gun violence. We are also engaged in electoral work to help replace elected officials who do not support common sense gun safety with candidates who will.
Did your organization get started? Was it because of what happened in Parkland? Is that when it really got started, or did it start way before then?
It did before that. So Moms Demand Action started with a Facebook page from one mom, Shannon Watts, in Indiana, the day after the tragic shooting in Newtown, Connecticut at Sandy Hook.
Okay.
And in 2014, Moms Demand Action joined with Mayors Against Legal Guns, which was begun by former Mayor Mike Bloomberg of New York City. The two organizations merged to become Everytown for Gun Safety, and we've been operating under that organizational structure since 2014, so we've been around since 2012.
You were talking about getting candidates on the state and federal level into office to back some kind of real gun reform. Can you talk a little bit about some of the candidates that you backed here in Michigan and whether or not they were able to prevail in the end in 2018?
So we had a really robust presence in the electoral process here in 2018. For the first time, Moms Demand Action was involved in supporting candidates all across the state ballot, across multiple states. So we elect gun safety candidate distinction was given to candidates for statewide office who support policies that are part of the most effective strategies for reducing gun violence, such as background checks, prohibiting domestic abusers from having guns, maintaining our permitting system, keeping guns out of sensitive spaces. And at the top of the ticket, Everytown for Gun Safety endorsed our now Attorney General, Dana Nessel, and our now Governor, Chris Whitmer, and multiple state Senate and state House candidates. Our gun safety candidates did very well. They performed excellently. Of course, not all won, but we put many, many gun safety candidates at all levels of our state government in the House and the Senate and in our executive branches.
We're speaking with Emily Durbin, who works with the Michigan chapter for Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America here on the Left of Lansing podcast. Emily, I'm going to admit to you that I'm not real optimistic that we are going to see any kind of real meaningful change, even after, you know, what this country experienced with these three horrific mass shootings over the past week. And of course, Chicago experienced more gun violence last week as well. And maybe that's just because I've been beaten down over the last 20 or so years, but especially after Sandy Hook, that it just appears like the NRA and many of its politicians are going to do whatever it takes to ensure that they will block any kind. And I'm talking even the most common sense kind of legislation from passing. Is there any reason why my pessimism is wrong this time around?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I'm here to give you a little hope. It's
okay.
Very hard.
Good.
We see this happening over and over again. There's also a narrative that gets propagated in the media and a narrative that suits the interests of the gun lobby to make all of us feel that it's hopeless, gun violence is inevitable, there's nothing to be done, it's so politically intransigent that we can't ever change, that talking about guns is toxic for political candidates, and in fact, all of those things are wrong. We proved that in the 2018 election, and we're going to prove that even more in 2020. After the tragedy in Parkland, we saw a real movement and a shift in the political conversation in this country around gun policy, and we now see many presidential candidates making this a central part of their platform. And more importantly, what we're seeing is a narrowing of the gap in between where the American people and constituents are and where these elected officials and candidates are. For a very long time, the American people was far ahead of our elected officials on gun safety. The vast majority of Americans, we're talking 90% plus, support background checks on all gun sales. Large majorities support prohibiting domestic abusers from having guns. Even the vast majority of gun owners and NRA members support these common sense policies. But for too long, their voices have not been heard by elected officials. And so the job of citizens is to hold our elected officials accountable and make sure that they are taking votes and proposing bills that are actually consistent with what the majority of their constituents want. We're seeing more and more people reaching out to elected officials about this. In many of the most recent elections, some of the polling has shown that gun policy and gun safety are among the top 2 to 3 issues for voters. They're issues that drive very strongly, in particular, the suburban vote. They also drive the youth vote. Those are two really important constituencies for both state and federal elections coming up. I think it's really important that people consider how we got to this space, which is that the NRA and the gun lobby worked for 25 years in state houses to slowly erode the public safety protections we have around gun safety. And the gun violence prevention movement is newer than that. But just in the span of 5 years, our organization, other GVP organizations, have worked very hard in state houses and have had an enormous win rate in terms of blocking bad gun bills and in many states moving the needle towards greater gun safety. So background checks on all gun sales, red flag bills in multiple states, prohibiting domestic abusers in multiple states. All of that's happened just over the past 5 years. So when you put that in the context of the 25-year battle the NRA has had at our state house, the gun violence prevention movement is rapidly making inroads in terms of translating that public sentiment into real public policy that will save lives.
You know, Emily, you brought up how things started to change after the Parkland tragedy, and I've heard many other gun reform activists say the same thing. And I was wondering if you believe that's because millennials and maybe the younger Generation Z voters decided to really get involved, especially on this issue. This is one issue that really does drive them to the polls. Do you think that's why we're also seeing a shift over the past few years, and that's why the NRA doesn't have complete dominance like it once did?
I think so. I think that's a big piece of it, especially from the more visible federal level.
Yeah.
At the state level, I think that work has been slower, but the prominence of this issue and the willingness of politicians who previously were on the other side to reconsider that position is largely about this very high-profile event that mobilizes an enormous number of young people, and politicians seeing the writing on the wall. It's very hard to win future elections when you're appealing to an aging demographic, when you're not capturing young voters, when you're losing voters in the suburbs, when you're losing women. Women drove the 2018 election, and women care a lot about this issue. And so I think it was a real inflection point and made clear what was going on under the surface all the time. And the power of the voice of those young people was undeniable. And I think the power of their voice gave many politicians the courage to speak out more openly and to start to propose more aggressive, more effective strategies than they had in the past. And it's really important that voters continue to do that, because we have to be the push behind them to ensure that they translate these things into action.
Emily, you said that we were seeing a big push to get some change on the federal level, but not so much maybe on the state level. Have you found it difficult to get voters and to get those who are on your side to understand that it's just one thing to get things passed on the federal level, but it's just as important to fight to get certain legislation passed on the state level? Have you found that difficult to get that message across?
It's incredibly important, because the vast majority of the laws that affect us, especially with regard to gun safety, are state laws. Because of the media landscape in this country, we hear a lot about issues at the federal level, and the gridlock and the partisanship that exists at the federal level pervades people's sense of how the political process works, which feeds into that narrative that everything is intractable and cannot change. Folks aren't always as aware of who their state representatives or state senators are as they might be about who their senator or their U.S. congressperson is. And so that's the role of our state-level volunteers, which is to get out and educate people in our communities about what the gun laws actually are here in Michigan, how they operate to impact people's daily lives and impact their safety, and then to educate people about bills that come before the state house or the state senate and how the passage of that bill would either increase their safety or put them at risk, and to give them the tools and train them about how to advocate with their state-level lawmakers. That work is absolutely critical.
We're speaking with Emily Durbin. She is a volunteer for the Michigan chapter of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America here on the Left of Lansing podcast. Since we are talking about stuff that's happening on the state level, let's talk about some bills that are sitting in our state legislature right now, because while there is talk on a federal level to pass some kind of legislation regarding red flags, I believe that we do have some of those bills, similar bills, sitting in both the state house and state senate. Is that true?
We do. That's right. We do. Red flag bills introduced in the Michigan House and in the Senate this past fall, I believe. A similar version, a red flag bill, was also introduced in the Michigan House by Robert Wittenberg, who's been a sponsor both times, last session. That bill last session and the bills this session have never been brought to a committee. They've been assigned but have not gotten a hearing.
Okay. Unreal. Do you think this kind of legislation, the red flag legislation, actually will receive a hearing once the state legislature reconvenes?
I hope so. That's our plan. Our plan is to have members themselves, members doing outreach and having constituents calling these offices and explaining just how critical this issue is to their vote and to their sense that they're being adequately represented by their local officials. So when we talk with people about these bills and how they operate, we hear so many stories of people who are survivors of gun violence, who've had family members killed, who can tell you that having the tools to reach out to law enforcement to temporarily restrict their loved one's access to a firearm would have saved them from dying by gun suicide. And we have a very high rate of gun suicide, particularly in northern Michigan, here in our state. And it is critically important that lawmakers hear the voices of people who've been personally impacted. The vast majority of Americans and Michiganders know someone who died by firearm homicide or suicide, and they need to hear those voices, and they need to emphasize that the same gun lobby talking points are not a reason not to advance this legislation.
You know, you bring up a great point, because while mass shootings, as horrific as they are, they make the headlines. I mean, we always have to read horrible or watch or listen to horrible stories day in and day out when it comes to gun violence. I mean, I think I saw a stat that said some 4.43 Americans out of 100 deaths in the United States are caused by gun violence. I mean, those are staggering statistics, Emily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100 people approximately every day are killed in everyday American gun violence, which is disturbing to think that we have a phrase called everyday gun violence. And a large number, approximately two-thirds of those deaths, are death by firearm suicide. We don't often hear the stories of people who are relatively disadvantaged or impacted by gun violence in our communities. And, you know, their safety isn't always foregrounded. Their stories aren't always brought to the fore when we talk about this issue, and it's absolutely critical. You know, gun violence affects not just the people who personally knew the person lost, but they affect the entire community and erode people's sense of safety. And it's part of a much broader issue in our country in terms of protecting those who are have been marginalized and disadvantaged, and not just persons of color, people are economically disadvantaged. The trans community, which we know in Detroit in particular, has been hit hard by violence, including gun violence, but also women and children who bear the brunt of violence at the hand of domestic abusers. You know, 50 American women are shot and killed by a current or former intimate partner every month, and there's a bill, a bipartisan bill, sitting in the Michigan House that would give local law enforcement the ability to enforce the federal prohibition against convicted domestic abusers possessing or purchasing guns. We don't have a state law, and most states do. It's really important that lawmakers attend to the risk that they're putting on Michigan women and their children by not moving this legislation.
I hope you don't mind me quickly just asking you a strategic question, but Governor Whitmer also announced, because she did announce her support for the red flag legislation, she's pushing for that, but she also said this week that she wouldn't mind maybe going after a ban on assault rifles. Do you think that's a possibility here in Michigan right now, or should Democrats and gun reform groups such as Moms Demand Action simply just push for red flag laws and expanded background checks for now, because that's where the people really are at the moment?
Yeah, so I think, you know, from the perspective of our organization, our volunteers, our ultimate goal is to end and prevent gun violence in this country. And so we always prioritize those policies that we know will have the biggest impact in terms of saving the most lives. And from the empirical database, we know that background checks at every gun sales, prohibiting domestic abusers from getting access to guns, and strong permitting systems are really important elements of that. Yeah. What we do know from the evidence base in terms of assault weapons ban, it seems that the element of that that was the most effective in terms of preventing gun violence are limits on magazine capacity. And because that's somewhat broader, and because some handguns or pistols can accept high-capacity magazines, that also helps to reduce gun violence that happens by handguns. Most firearm deaths in America are deaths that happen by pistols or handguns. I think it's important to be having a discussion about all of the strategies that are empirically supported for reducing gun violence, because we know that no one strategy is not going to help eliminate or reduce all forms of gun violence. It takes many forms in this country, and I think it's a smart strategy to be discussing a variety of mechanisms that we could pursue and to be most aggressive about those policies that we know have the best evidence base and will save the most lives.
We've been speaking here with Emily Durbin. She's a volunteer for the Michigan chapter of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. Emily, just one more quick question. And you're such an awesome guest, by the way. Thanks again for doing this.
Yeah, my pleasure.
You know, we're talking about all of these common sense measures, and they are common sense measures that your group is advocating for. It just is common sense. But state legislative Republicans here in Michigan keep pushing for expanded gun rights. I mean, there are bills right now. One was brought forth by Representative Bo LaFave, and he wants to expand concealed carry in schools and bars and churches. And then I think there's even a bill, if I'm not mistaken, to allow concealed carry without even a permit. So I hear all this, and I feel like, are we living in alternate universes?
You know, that permitless carry proposal also was brought up in the prior legislative session, and we fought back very hard against that. We believe it's really important that for all of us who are moving about in public spaces, there's an oversight system for who's able to carry a hidden loaded weapon in public, and that they have at least some minimum of training, and that we're prohibiting people who have a dangerous history from doing so. I think there is a very concerted effort to sell a narrative of fear that encourages people to believe that they must carry a gun on their person in order to be safe. You know, that narrative is used to support proposals like people should be allowed to carry their hidden loaded gun in public without any questions asked. And our organization supports keeping our permitting system. We think, you know, there's evidence that permitting systems are an important component of gun violence prevention, and that people who wish to carry their weapon should be able to handle it responsibly, to have training, be aware of the laws, and that our system prohibits particular people, including those who are convicted of domestic abuse or violent crimes, from getting a CPL.
Emily, I just have to say this. Growing up in the 1990s and living through the 2000s, it seemed as if there would never be a real huge organized movement to go against the power the National Rifle Association had on its legislative leaders throughout the country. And I'm not just talking about on the federal level, but I'm also talking about on state levels throughout the country. I never thought that we'd actually see a real counterbalance against the NRA. But I'm wrong, because we have groups such as Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America doing the fight and providing that counterbalance for all of us who are just looking for some kind of real, sensible, common sense gun reform. If there are some people listening to this podcast who would like to learn more about your organization and learn how to get more involved, how can they do so?
Yeah, really easily. They can just text the word READY, READY, to the number 64433, or visit us at momsdemandaction.org, and they will get a phone call within a very short period of time from a really engaged volunteer to join the most powerful group of people. It's not just mothers, it's also dads and non-parents and survivors and gun owners, but the most powerful group of people I've ever been involved with, and it will give you a sense of hope and purpose.
Emily Durbin with Michigan Chapter of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. Thanks a lot for being on the Left of Lansing podcast today, and I hope that you'll consider coming back sometime again in the future.
Of course. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Left of Lansing podcast. Want to give Pat a piece of your mind? It's easy to reach him. Just send an email to leftoflansing@gmail.com. And don't forget to visit leftoflansing.com for more news and information.
Time for the Left of Lansing last call. That was a fantastic segment with Emily Durbin from the Michigan chapter of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. Emily was spot on throughout that entire interview. She reminded us of how firearms are used, for instance, in a majority of domestic violence deaths. She was right to remind us that we have to fight on every level, local, state, and federal level. We can't just fight to change everything on the federal level. While important, yes, we have to ensure that we make change happen right here in Michigan. More importantly, Emily told us that we can no longer simply sit down and be quiet. We can't do that anymore, everyone. That's why, that's what the NRA and its right-wing allies have relied on for years. It's time we fight back. It's time that we make our voices heard. And if our voices won't be heard, then we change the refs, as the Parkland students say. And we put people in state legislatures, and we put people in Congress who will hear our voice. So thank you, Emily, for being on this podcast. By the way, I forgot to mention this one part in my monologue when talking about how conservatives went ballistic when Homeland Security released its report about the looming danger of right-wing extremism back in 2009. The LA Times noted back on August the 5th, and I quote, "Under the current occupant of the White House, 85% of the countering violent extremism grants awarded by Homeland Security explicitly targeted Muslims and other minority groups, including immigrants and refugees, more than under the Obama administration, according to an analysis by the Brennan Center for Justice, a nonpartisan policy institute at the New York University School of Law." Wow. But yet, not shocking. Finally, I'd like to give one of my favorite Michigan State Senators and friend of this podcast, Democratic Senator Mallory McMorrow from Royal Oak, the final word on this podcast. She posted a statement on her Twitter page last week, and I'd like to share it right here. Let this serve as a rallying cry for those of us fighting to make Michigan a safer state.
I am beyond words for what to say right now. It feels so hopeless. It feels frustrating. And just to illustrate my point, yes, there is a red flag bill package that I am a part of that Robert Wittenberg has been working on for years that has never gotten a hearing in the Michigan legislature and needs to. But more frustrating than that, I introduced a resolution in the Senate just to recognize Gun Violence Awareness Day. And that resolution didn't pass. We can't even acknowledge that gun violence is an issue, and I don't want to hear that now is not the time to talk about it. The time to talk about it was before Dayton. The time to talk about it was before El Paso. The time to talk about it was before Parkland. The time to talk about it was before Sandy Hook and Virginia Tech. And because we didn't talk about it then, the time to act is now. And anybody who is standing in the way of that action needs to be held accountable and needs to be voted out of office. We have a gun violence public health crisis in our country and in our states. We have a white supremacy problem, we have a hatred problem, and we need to acknowledge them all and address them head on.
Call your congressman, call your congresswoman, call your senators, call your state legislators, call our governor, and call our awesome state attorney general, and tell them all that we are ready for change now. Tell them that we are ready to change the refs.
You're listening to the Left of Lansing podcast. The music you're hearing is by Wanderbeats. To hear more, visit wanderbeats.net. That's wanderbeats.net. Now back to Pat Johnston.
Whew. Well, that's going to do it for this edition of the Left of Lansing podcast. I hope it was well worth the wait. Thanks for standing by and thanks for sticking with me. Don't worry, I will be back next week with yet another episode. In the meantime, stay engaged and keep fighting. The occupant and his cronies want us to fight amongst each other. They want to divide us because the longer they divide us, the longer they can keep passing tax cuts and laws designed to benefit them and them only. They want to keep the game rigged. They want to keep that revolving door between Washington, D.C. and Wall Street from turning and turning and turning. They don't want us to get in between and jam it up. They don't want us to stop that revolving door. They want to keep us divided so that way they keep benefiting. We can't allow that, which is why we must always make sure to take the battle to them. Thank you, Michigan!
The Left of Lansing podcast was produced by Pat Johnston. Written by Pat Johnston. Researched by Pat Johnston. Just kidding, this thing isn't researched. And broadcasted by Pat Johnston. Technical assistance provided by the wonderful Dr. Heather. And don't forget to visit leftoflansing.com for more news and information. And Pat's musical taste, if you can handle it. Thanks again for listening to the Left of Lansing podcast.